You're listening to the Elevate Podcast, and I'm your host, Robert Glazer. Join me as I talk to world-class performers about how they build their capacity and reach greater heights in leadership, business, and life, and how you can do the same. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast and another edition of Weekend Conversations. Each week, I'll take a deeper dive into an article or interview that I shared during the week. And joining me to do this is Mick, co-producer of the Elevate Podcast. How's it going, Mick?
It's going well, Bob. How are you?
Good. Another week. We're at the end.
So what are we talking about today?
We're going to talk about a story that led us to talk about a concept called a stop loss, which is a term from investing, but sort of has applications well beyond the investing world.
Yeah. So this was the subject of yesterday's Friday Forward called Stop Loss, appropriately enough. And as you said, it's an investing tactic, which to people who aren't familiar, it essentially is an order to sell an investment if it dips below a certain price. So for example, you might buy a stock for $100 a share and you might order a stop loss that automatically sells it if the price falls to $85 a share to avoid catastrophic losses. So why did you focus a post on this?
Yeah, I was looking at a couple of the investments I made over the last couple of years that are down pretty considerably and realizing that I probably fell victim to what we're talking about today. I mean, I know about a stop loss. I should use it on every investment, particularly in the short term or things that tend to kind of move more. They're a little more speculative, but I didn't. And you know, thinking through why there were a lot of implications, but so this started with a little bit of personal pain.
The interesting thing, you acknowledge this in the post itself, but I think that some people, especially if they, well, I don't know if an experienced investor or an unexperienced investor would be more likely to pose this question, but essentially, why would you take a guaranteed 15% loss on something knowing that markets can be volatile, like it could bounce back, stuff like that? And I think that the distinction here is, unlike something like if you have an index fund that traces the S&P 500, for example, like you can imagine that even if that collapses in price briefly, you can expect to eventually come out ahead. But if, say, you're holding an individual stock in like a particular industry, as you put in the piece, negative momentum can stay negative and compound against you over time.
Yeah, you might buy something that's down 30% and think it's a great deal. It can still go down another 80%, and I think we just fail to calculate that, and we fail to see how negative momentum can get in some cases. And I think we tend to be irrational, and particularly in the moment, emotions take over logic. So the concept of a stop loss, again, in investing, is just pre-going in and saying, look, this is the most I'm willing to lose. And knowing that, like, in the and a lot of people turn them off, and there's actually some data about who turns them off and when they turn them off. They actually turn off their sell orders for a profit because they actually turn them earlier. Like when they say, I'll sell it if it goes up 15%, they tend to sell it when it goes off 10. And then they tend to turn off their stop losses, which gets into what we're going to talk about a little bit, kind of loss aversion. But it is really interesting. And I think the more that we understand these kind of forces that we're subject to, particularly in our decision making, it comes into play a lot in our leadership world.
Yeah. So you said the big concept, which is loss aversion theory. And this is something that comes from Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Kahneman is probably the more widely known of the two because he wrote the book Thinking Fast and Slow. But Amos Tversky was Kahneman's basically research partner for years before he became a widely published author. And so essentially, if I understand it correctly, the concept of loss aversion theory says that we are, to simplify it, much more disappointed by a loss of a certain amount than we are by a gain of the same amount.
Yeah, so that's part A, and that doesn't sound that crazy. But again, when you think about gambling, the pain of losing is more than the enjoyment of winning, which is just an interesting thing to know. What becomes the interesting factor is what happens next. And what happens next is, when we're losing, we will start betting on luck and doing irrational things just to claw back to even. When we're already up, we don't want to put, think about it, when we're up, we don't want to put anything to fate. We want to like take our gain and sort of run with it. And which is interesting, again, in the concept of momentum, momentum can run longer than we think. So when you kind of sell your winners that are still running and let your losers run, you end up sort of with the worst of both worlds. But this notion that we don't want to take any luck for chance that would wipe out our gain, right? Because we don't get that much pleasure, but we're willing to take all kinds of luck to try to claw back to zero, to do anything to avoid a loss.
Loss aversion theory is almost a collision between the rational and the emotional sides of yourself kind of fighting against each other, because on some level you would expect that if people tend to be loss averse, they might like the concept of saying, oh, you know, this investment I made is down 10%. I should like get out because I'll be devastated if I lose more. But as you just said, that's not what people do, actually. You're much more likely to see someone who says, well, I'm going to put more money into this investment so that I can get back to even later.
Just going to say, we talked about this. I don't remember the topic, but in housing. So after the housing crash, there are people who wouldn't sell their house for 10 years until they could get the price they originally paid for it, even though the market was down 30%. And even though they were trying to buy a bigger, more expensive house at a discount, so they would have been better off. You're better off trading a $500,000 house that's down 10% for a $1 million house that's down 10%, right? Objectively, you're going to save more money, but they were even irrational on both sides of that coin. I'm going to negotiate you know, for the 10% off a million, but I'm not taking a penny less than the $500,000 for my house. So you just see how this plays out, and eventually, I think people hurt themselves by kind of holding on to these irrationalities.
Another extremely common example of this that's pretty tangible for people is with gambling, for example. And if you've heard of the concept of someone being on tilt because they've lost and they're throwing more and more money at the game that they're betting on to attempt to get it back. Or, you know, you'll often hear anytime someone loses a bet, they'll immediately say double or nothing. And what they're doing is basically they're threatening to double their loss just for the possibility of getting back to zero.
Yeah. And what is the strategy that a lot of gamblers employ when they're winning? The first thing is they start, you know, they pocket their original money and they take they only play with their winnings on a hot streak. Well, that's kind of like to ensure they don't have a loss, right? Even though they're on a hot streak, anything to ensure they kind of don't have a loss is interesting. This actually even extends before this about, I was reading a study this week of cab drivers over a long time. And I was actually talking with a Lyft driver about this yesterday. It probably applies. But when they want to make a certain amount of money per day, the drivers make the wrong decision. So let's say their goal is 300 and they're out there and it's like super hot out there and there's tons of rides. They stop at 300, right? They get their number, but that's actually a day where the earning potential was probably $600. And then on another day when it's super slow and there's no one out there, they basically stay out there and work 10 hours to make $150. And again, that's sort of a loss aversion concept playing out. And they looked at the math and they said, this is the absolute wrong strategy. You should hang it up like on a day where it's bad, and you should stay out there when it's hot.
To the point of the many examples of this we've been citing, this really is the type of concept that once you know about it, you start to see it everywhere. I want to ask about the leadership implications of thinking about loss aversion and thinking about applying a stop loss. In this case, do you think that a leader should use these concepts to, for example, if they invest in a new business line, if they roll out a new initiative, you know, they should have a certain threshold in mind that they are willing to invest time and money and effort into before cutting their losses?
Yeah, and look, people is another big part of that. And so while it may not be as cutthroat from a financial number, I think it's really important when you go into something to say how much energy, how much resources, against what sort of outcome am I willing to do, and kind of hold yourself to that. Because so many people fall into the sunk cost fallacy. So many people throw good money after bad. And at some point, you just have to admit that something is not working and move on to something. You might be doubling down on something that's not working, and you have something that is working that's getting starved of resources. Or, you know, if you went in, you said, look, if I have a salesperson and they miss their first, you know, their quota, first three quarters of quota, my failure rate is 99%. So the next time someone misses three quarters of quota, like, that's the cue to pause. Well, then in the moment, you can start talking yourself out of that and convincing yourself. But if you talk to leaders who have talked themselves out of making these decisions, and someone has said the best time to make a decision is the first time it pops in your mind, like, I don't think that Mick is going to work out, the end result is almost always what they expected it to be. It's just more time and more pain. So look, sometimes things are close or otherwise, but I think the general point is that in the moment, we are likely to let our emotions and our fears and stuff overtake our kind of rational logic versus going in and saying, look, we're going to launch this new product. And if it doesn't get traction in four quarters, you know, meaningful traction, then we need to shut it down. And kind of like putting that as a hard and fast rule so that you don't fall into that emotional trap and then just end up costing yourself both a lot of money and resources in something that probably is not going to work, but then starving that money and resources from things that may actually be working that you're so distracted trying to get out of the loss on that you're hurting them.
It relates to another concept that you've written and talked about plenty previously, which is being mindful of the overall odds and following the odds rather than the exception. And the example that I think is interesting that you cited there is, you said hypothetically, let's say 99 times out of 100, if someone misses a certain number of quarters of their quota in a row, they're not going to turn it around. And I think that a stop loss, what that does is it dials into that rational understanding up front before you're actually in the trenches experiencing the loss and having the difficult decision point. Because when you're in that moment, it is amazing the things that you can tell yourself and convince yourself of. And in a lot of cases, it actually can come from pride where you say, well, I hired this person, I bet on this person, I invested in training this person, I like this person, I'm going to give them a shot because they don't want to acknowledge that maybe it was a mistake that they're better off moving on from.
Yeah, and I think everyone falls victim to that. So it's kind of like writing a letter to yourself and saying, you know, here's what I'm going to do. I talked about a similar example. You know, I think people who invest in startups, right, or angel investment, you know, those companies always come back. They're missing plan. They're off plan. They want more money. It's very hard not to throw good money after bad or want it, like the chance of you just invest more money or lose all of your money. And I remember talking to an investor years ago and he was like, look, there was a rule with his wife. I don't remember what it was, $50,000. But he's like, it's just, there's no more than that per deal. Like, I just don't even, that's a hard and fast rule. I'm accountable to her for it. And accountability is a good part of this. Who are you accountable for? And the stop loss, you know, you're accountable to the bank who puts it in there. They're not going to not run it, right? Unless you turn it off. But, you know, that way the company, you know, he just couldn't fall to the temptation of kind of doubling down on his bad investments.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? 2 years ago, I bought a dual suspension mountain bike for the first time, and it pushed me to ride trails that I had never been willing to try before. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has exceptional capability that will have you seeing the possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. The Lexus GX comes with available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, best-in-class towing capacity, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. I've seen the new Lexus GX popping up all around my town, and not only does it have the capabilities to take you to new places on and off the road, but it's a great-looking car. The new Lexus GX is ready to raise the bar for you. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and free. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. It helps you identify and hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. Case in point, last year I asked the CEO of a major ski resort how he got his job, and he told me that he saw it on LinkedIn and decided to apply. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. The team at LinkedIn is also constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process easier and quicker. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/practical. That's linkedin.com/practical to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
And if you want an example of doubling down on something, just Google WeWork and SoftBank. That's a pretty good example. So it, in terms of, obviously, it's very easy to calibrate with financial stuff because you can just say, it's X amount of money I'm willing to lose, and that's that. And there's a very clear calibration built into it. What about in cases like if you're investing your time or your effort or your energy into something? How do you sort of upfront say, well, I'm willing to put like this number of months into this new activity or into this new, you know, this new partnership, et cetera?
I think it's about being reflective and thinking about these up front and thinking what good looks like. You know, this is where it's helpful for people that write in a journal, have that routine or do kind of goal planning, because you can put that stuff down and then you can measure yourself, you know, against it. Like if I set a goal for this year, I can see as I get to the second quarter that I'm just like way off, and I can be like, you know what, this is just, I was wrong, like this isn't going to happen this year, I gotta stop. You know, that could either be motivating to kind of speed it up or kind of bail on it. But I do think this is where might be the type of reflective thoughts in a journal or otherwise. But before you commit your time, your resources, your energy, I think about what, as you said, it's not number, what does good look like, what does success look like, what does failure look like, and what would be the conditions by which you pulled, you know, a parachute, you know, thinking about getting into something with a roommate or a relationship or otherwise. And you could even say like, look, like I'm, you know, I've heard some people, you know, in the sort of maybe like, you know, couples relate, like if we go to dinner with this person again and he brings up this topic again and we get into this again, like I'm out. Like, I just like, I don't want to have this discussion or talk about this anymore, or like, this is not a relation, that if this is what we're going to talk about anytime, this is not a relationship that has a positive return for me. So I actually think it's the people who are just a little more introspective, do a little planning, and again, can say, objectively say, like, what does good look like and feel like? Am I willing to acknowledge when that's not happened? And how many people would probably be better off even too in a relationship, you know, to think about like, what does good look like? You can always convince yourself, well, they're not going to do it again or whatever. And I mean, everyone, we're really good at lying to ourselves, right? Because of cognitive dissonance, because of our wanting to protect ourselves from feeling like we made a bad choice. When I'm actually reading the book now, and this will be in an upcoming podcast because we're interviewing Annie Duke on the book Quit. But her whole thing, and in poker, like the best poker players know how to walk away from the losing hands. In fact, they ride the hot hands and they walk away from the losing hand. That's what makes you a good poker. So her whole book is about how do you quit and when do you quit and why quitting actually allows you to live another day to do other stuff. It ties into this. It's really interesting.
And you don't have to necessarily say, I have these boxes to check from if I want to be friends with someone or something like that. But I think that there is a lot of value, and this isn't something that people naturally think of, to basically saying, you know, what are things that I find really valuable in the people that I'm friends with? Like, what kind of time do I want to invest? What do I want to get out of? Stuff like that. It can seem, I think, a little bit cynical to be calculating about people in that way, but it's not really, because it's not really doing anyone any good to like be investing in a relationship or a friendship or a partnership with a person if you're not really in it. Like that is something that I've actually encountered in talking about like relationship questions with other people. And in a lot of cases, it's very common for someone to have that feeling of inertia where like they don't want to break up with someone, even if they know it's wrong, because they don't want to hurt the other person. And it doesn't get, it very rarely gets better in my experience. You're just making the, you're putting it off because you don't want to have the hard conversation now. And you're saying that it's for the benefit of the other person, but it's really not, because it's going to be a lot worse to have that breakage later.
Yeah, a couple of things. A, we all have seen this. When the breakage happens later, everyone goes back to the revisionist history, you know, when the blow up happens, and they start listing all the things over the last 6 to 12 months. And so that never, inevitably, they can't help themselves, right? You've done this 12 times in a row and all this stuff. This ties to another one of our most popular guests on the podcast and a great topic that we wrote about called energy vampires. And that's a simple test. Like, is someone an energy vampire? Do I feel worse spending time with them after spending time with them? Are they sort of a net energy drag? And I think that's an objective thing. And look, we have a lot of these. There, Donda Pandey, who talked about that, gave me some great advice years ago. It's not that you actually need to like break up, right? You don't have to have a formal breakup. You just need to kind of quit and not apply energy to that. So we all have these, and particularly people in relationships, I think they have like, you know, some couples friends or one where there one person was more friends with someone, but then they come with a partner that's not great, and hey, we should catch up, and we go out to dinner, and like that's one of the things that you can be like, look, we went out to dinner and like it was like not, it was fine, it's not, and then we said we should do this again, and like we didn't really mean it, like I don't really want to do it again, like I barely catch up with this person anymore, and their partner's, you know, not our favorite all. That to me is again a thing of like, look, we'll just not make those plans. Like that's the sort of quitting, and that's the stop loss. Like this is a net negative. I would rather go spend another 2 hours at dinner with someone I care about or someone I'm close with, or, you know, I have, you know, meaningful, than this causal relationship that really is kind of, if I think about it, is neutral to net negative for me overall.
And this is something that happens a lot with long-term friendships, I would say, where it doesn't even necessarily mean that if you grow apart and have a different life from someone than you had when you were friends with them at first and you had more in common, doesn't mean that the friendship doesn't have value. But it's the type of thing that you kind of know it when you see it. Like if you're in a relationship and if you are friends with someone who, say, all of their relationships like end very badly because that person's not trustworthy. Like if you have that type of thing and that really goes against your values personally, if maybe your partner is like, you know, I don't know why you're spending time with them. That doesn't seem like they are the best person. And if the response to that is, well, they've been my friend for X number of years, you kind of need to stop loss yourself there, because that's really in and of itself not enough of a justification if it's a person that you don't share values with, that you don't have things in common with.
Yeah, and it's actually, look, one of the best tactics that that is easy. You don't need to break up with a person or whatever. You just need to not find a date or not say we should get together when we don't mean it or all these things that are similar things to convincing yourself, you know, that why something isn't working and why you just need to give it another run. You know, this is under umbrella of just saying no and kind of opening up the space for the things that you want to do. So it is interesting how it really has similar, I think, properties in a lot of areas outside the financial world. And again, if we just spend some time, again, we're going to go to dinner and like, I'm going to think about in my mind, like, what does good look like? What does like, I want to do this again look like? And what is like, I really don't want to do this again look like? And then I can objectively make a decision after that.
It's the type of thing also, this ties into a concept you wrote about in Leadership Minute a few weeks ago, the sort of zero-based commitment strategy. And I think that is a good litmus test for whether you need to cut your losses from something is, you know, if I wasn't already invested in this stock, would I buy it today? Like, if I wasn't already part of this community organization or on this like community advisory board, would I join it today? If you start from zero, you think of things from that it's almost like you're returning to that upfront rational phase of things rather than being caught in the middle, more emotional phase.
Yeah, and this gets right into the sunk cost fallacy, right? Like if I had no money in this, would I invest money more today? Knowing what this project's been failing for 9 months, this new product launch. So now I actually even have more data on how hard it is and how risky it is. And I know we're $100,000 into it, but like if I wouldn't invest today, then it's just so hard to walk away from a loss. But again, the goal is to kind of live another day and reallocate. And we always underestimate, just because we've already lost an amount, just because I lost 20% in that solar stock, you know, didn't mean I couldn't lose 80%, which ended up happening. So I think we underestimate how much of a loss we can have in some situations.
Yeah, you can always lose more in a lot of cases. And that's, I think, one of the things behind the black swan concept that Nassim Nicholas Taleb wrote about, which is, you know, the low end of your expectations is often based on your prior history, but that's ignoring the fact that you don't have all the information, you haven't seen all of the potential outcomes, and there could always be a negative outcome beyond what you could foresee and expect.
Yeah, one of his simplest examples is that every insurance company rates storms to the biggest storm or the 100-year storm. But before that storm, no one had seen a storm that big, right? So he said they're just constantly underestimating how much money they can lose and what the risk is and what the beta, you know, on sort of that risk is, because they're going by what they've seen. And you know, situations have changed. We have, you know, global warming on the planet that's different. And I'm sure that insurance companies are woefully, you know, misunderstanding risk in a lot of cases. You know, I love when people keep talking about one of my favorite things, they don't even realize the ridiculousness of the statement when they keep talking about, you know, 100-year storm. And I'm like, this is the third one in 3 years. And you keep calling it 100-year storm, right? That doesn't make any sense.
Oh yeah. Or another, frankly, a grim example of this is when the earthquakes and tsunami in Fukushima about, oh my goodness, that was over 10 years ago at this point. Yeah, but that was essentially the infrastructure in Japan. The seawalls were built based on expectations from the largest recorded prior tsunamis that they had experienced. And then there was one that was larger, which there had, you know, there's actually a really interesting New Yorker article about this from like 10 years ago, but there actually had been a larger tsunami than ever had been recorded before in Japan. It was just 300 years ago before data was being collected.
Yeah. So yeah, we're not great at thinking about what could go wrong. And I think, again, similarly, it is interesting. Sometimes we cut the cord on things when they're going right too early, because again, momentum tends to run longer than we think, but then it eventually turns. It could be a whole number of Friday forward, but I always like to say that, you know, any parabolic line I have found on any chart is usually met with an equal and opposite parabolic line shortly after. However, in any craze or whatever, it's actually the last third of the run-up that has about, you know, most of the gain. So it's very hard to pick the top and the timing, but a lot of the velocity is right before it turns the other direction.
Harvard Business Review provides information, tools, and practical advice on leadership, management, and strategy through the hbr.org website, their print publication, and their podcast. hbr.org is your go-to for leadership and business management articles. A recent favorite is Stop Eliminating Perfectly Good Candidates by Asking Them the Wrong Questions. Then there are other world-famous case studies, which premium subscribers can access as well. HBR produces a number of leading podcasts, from HBR on Leadership to my favorite, the HBR IdeaCast podcast. A subscription to HBR also includes access to videos, The Big Idea, HBR Magazine, and a wide variety of newsletters. While much of the Harvard Business Review content is available for free after signing up at their site, subscriptions to unlimited content start at only $10 a month. Go to www.hbr.org/subscriptions and enter promo code ELEVATE right now to take advantage of this great offer. Again, go to www.hbr.org/subscriptions and enter promo code ELEVATE to learn more about this great opportunity to help manage your career and business.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, there's definitely a sequel in here of timing the market and stuff like that.
Well, I had a Friday Forward I want to write about parabolic lines, because whatever the topic is, anytime a chart I've seen a line pretty much go vertical, it's amazing whether it's a year or a month or whatever, there's usually an equal and opposite line that brings it back into the normal progression.
That should be a good one. That's a little sneak preview for the listeners. So the quote of the week is from Annie Duke, who you mentioned earlier. The worst time to make a decision is when you're in it. What resonates with you about this quote?
Yeah, I think this sort of like really explains, like, again, why do this in advance? And that, again, we are emotional beings, and in the moment, our emotions will overtake our rational logic. So, you know, thinking about all the outcomes or what did you do, I think what made Annie a great poker player, and we'll talk about this in a lot of them, is that, or if you play blackjack, you have a rule set in your head and you just, yeah, you take some risk but you follow that rule set. You don't say, oh, I just, you know what, I feel good about this and I'm going to go all in on my twos. And yeah, some very kind of risky players or some, you know, do that, but that is not what the people that win consistently tend to do. They follow the rules, they follow their logic set, and because they know in the heat of the moment, again, when you think about what causes someone to go all in or otherwise, it's not that the cards, they know all those hands and they know the logic. It's looking around the table and getting more confident or less confident based on how many chips they have or how many chips the other person have. Nothing about the equation has actually changed.
Absolutely. It's really ties together the conversation.
Thanks for listening today, everyone. If you want to check out the post we were just discussing, go to robertglaser.substack.com and look for the post titled Stop Loss. There are also a few other posts that we mentioned in there that could be helpful. There's one on cognitive dissonance and one on energy vampires, if you search for those as well. Keep your eye out for future edition of Weekend Conversations coming to your feed on Saturday mornings. And if you haven't yet subscribed to the show, please follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast app, because that's how you find all the new episodes. Until next time, keep elevating. Hello, Elevate Podcast listeners. I wanted to let you know about my friend Darius and his amazing show, The Greatness Machine. The Greatness Machine is one of the top-ranked educational and business podcasts in the country, recently ranking top 5 in the entrepreneurial category on iTunes. Here's why I love Darius and The Greatness Machine. It really comes down to a few things. The Greatness Machine has amazing guests from the likes of sports icon Gabby Reese, worldwide news sensation Amanda Knox, FBI hostage negotiator Chris Voss, and Tiny Habits expert and author BJ Fogg, to NHL Hall of Famer Chris Pronger, and hundreds more. Darius keeps it real. I always learn something new, and I have a few laughs. And he always also asks great questions and is a really entertaining and engaging host. The Greatness Machine is where you get to be a fly on the wall and listen to Darius and his amazing group of guests talk about how they got to where they are today and hear stories of people who have lived their passions to create greatness in the world and doing so despite the odds. So if you want to be entertained while learning from some of the greatest and most accomplished people in the world, this is definitely a show for you to check out. Subscribe to The Greatness Machine today on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap, Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or YAP, like it's often called by my YAP fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.